Welcome to a very timely episode of The Dirty Inning. I am Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight, and with me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports, filling in for Dr. Trevor Strunk. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin. I'm Liz, so happy to be here.
I was going to say, Liz, have you ever done one of these before? Because I think we're about to go for a ride.
I've never done one of these before, but I listened and hoped that one day it would be me.
Well, you're
and
in
now,
for,
now I get the chance.
You're in for quite the treat.
Yes.
I'm sure you know the gist of this podcast by now, as I'm sure everyone listening does as well. We obviously go back and talk about the most obscure, most forgotten, dumbest innings in Phillies history. And boy, when you get a lead-in to do an episode in the current Phillies season, like we got last Friday, I believe, against the Marlins, not only did it enter my head that, like, huh, you know, we're watching one of these happen, and, you know, watching history happen right before our eyes. Not only did that occur to me, it occurred to an impressive number of people who reached out to me, to Trev, to the podcast, and really just said, hey, there is a dirty inning happening right now. And that inning was, of course, the bottom of the third in the game against the Marlins on, it was Friday, right? This was a weekend series. It was Friday, the 23rd of August, when the Phillies and Marlins played that terrible game. We've done a lot of bitching and moaning about that in the present, but what we didn't really talk about is the history that loss made. It was cited again and again how that game and the Phillies' 7-0 lead that they put together in the first four innings that eventually evaporated into a 19-11 loss to the worst team in the National League. That was a little bit of history because the Phillies hadn't blown a lead of that size, Liz, since 2003. And in 2003, they hadn't blown a lead of that size since 1979.
This feels so good.
Yeah, so we're going to go back in time. We're going to take a little trip, as we do on this podcast. We're going to go take a look at both the game in 2003 and the game in 1979, just to get a little context. And to also see, you know, once again, how repetitive things are around here in Phillies country. You know, just to recap a little bit, Liz, I know we cried our eyes out dry, and we talked ourselves hoarse about that game, so we don't really have to entirely relive it. I'm going to recite a few details that we've probably already discussed. But, you know, like I said, the Phillies blew a lead in their first game of a three-game set against the Marlins on Friday. After scoring in each of the first four innings, the mighty, if obscured, Phillies offense put up 7 runs against a last-place team, which really should have been enough to win the game. Really, it should have, regardless of anything. It's just that should have been enough right there. But it wasn't. The Marlins hammered Vince Velasquez and Nick Pivetta and scored 19 runs from the fifth inning on to beat the Phillies 19-11. Jim Salisbury called it a 4-hour, 10-minute insult to baseball. Vince Velasquez said
wow.
Vince Velasquez said he was flat out embarrassed by the game. Matt Breen of the Inquirer called the bottom of the third the worst inning of the year for the Phillies, and Gabe Kapler called it unacceptable. Whatever that means, because, you know, it's not that I'm like picking out the Gabe Kapler quotes to just like focus on specifically, but I'm like,
they're all the same.
They're like so flat out insult. Like when the press is like, you could hear the groaning from the beat writers. They were just like dropping any form of objectivity. And they were like, this is dog shit. This is absolutely terrible. Meanwhile, Gabe Kapler's like, it's unacceptable, which like on its own, it's a very strong word. You know, yeah, that's unacceptable. That's not going to happen. But you know what? It means nothing. You're obviously going to accept. He can't. He's not going to challenge the loss. He's not going to go to the league and be like, hey, we're not going to. No. He's not going to go to his players and be
what
like.
What if he sounded like that, though?
He's not going to go to his players and be like, you're all fired. You know, like,
I have that power.
We're starting
I'm the dictator.
From scratch here. Like, come on. And if this was truly unacceptable, we wouldn't see. I mean, again, the historic nature of this loss was distinct, but we've seen plenty of blowout losses or dumb Phillies leads disappear this year. Like, if this kind of loss was unacceptable truly, then they would stop doing it. But apparently it is acceptable. And, you know, while we're at it, Gabe Kapler's not really in the right space to be saying anything's acceptable or unacceptable. Where that absolute mess happened before Monday night's game against the Pirates, where Cesar Hernandez wasn't in the lineup, and they were like, the reporters asked, "Hey, is this because he didn't hustle on that ball? He watched yesterday on Sunday, and Gabe Kapler said no. Well, yeah, actually it is. He said, he told reporters it is in response to that, but it is not a punishment. Then they asked Cesar if he thought he was being punished, and Cesar said, no, I was told I was just getting a normal off day.
Oh, God.
Oh, did you not see this? It was a riot.
I was given a brief summary by my husband, and that was it did not go into that much detail.
Oh, it's perfect. It's just a perfect situation.
It's
honestly,
like he's looped. It's like he took everyone's advice from last year and said, okay, I'm going to have the exact same attitude but say different things. He's doing the same. Like, it was insulting last year when he would do what he did and just be positive all the time and never be realistic. But now he's just, it's like a faux veneer of this is unacceptable. Well, I'm just going to go in my office and read another Michael Crichton novel. Like, what is he doing with his time?
It seems like he thought he could sneak it past everyone.
He
could bench Cesar, but not piss Cesar off. He could tell the reporters to tell them what the fans wanted to hear, which was that Cesar was being held accountable.
He's been doing this for almost two full seasons. I think he should have figured out that by now he's not smarter than us. We're not major league managers, but we do this every day. We're here too.
I mean,
like, what is he doing? Like we always say we have no idea what's happening in the organization, but this is like so nakedly stupid. Like, what is this?
Yeah, that was extremely poorly managed. And as someone pointed out to John Stolness, that the one thing he's supposed to be excellent at is communication. And if he's not even doing that well anymore, then what the hell are we doing? But I digress.
Oh my God. Do we?
Gabe Kapler calling something unacceptable right now is very rich. So that being said, this is about, you know, those things, those comments following the game. That's about all you can say to a Phillies team that either gave up too many runs to an offense in Miami that is in last place in the National League in most offensive categories. But the Phillies could also not score enough on a pitching staff that allowed 10 walks on two consecutive nights. So which bad Phillies team do you want to discuss? And the good news is we don't have to discuss any of those Phillies teams because this is the dirty inning. You know, we mentioned we're talking about other bad Phillies teams from way before.
Ones that have already done all of their stuff. We can look back on that with a lot less pain.
So this game, this 19-11 loss on Friday, that was the first time the Phillies had surrendered a 7-run lead since 2003. As many reporters pointed out, Todd Zielecki provided a link to the box score of that game against the Expos. So let's take a trip back, why don't we, Liz, to a time of early aught utopia when the Phillies all hated each other. But other than that, everything was pretty much the same. This was in 2003.
If they hated each other now, we wouldn't know.
Yeah, we wouldn't. I mean, these guys, and we keep saying it, they look like they actually like each other. But we did a dirty inning episode from 2003 where Tim Worrell, the reliever, punched out the Phillies pitching coach and broke his glasses. Had to be escorted out.
My God.
Before the reporters could find out what was going on.
Carlos Santana threw a TV last year. None of us found out about that until much later.
That's right. That's true. Hey, maybe there's more in common here than we realize. That's one of the things doing this podcast. You see, these things are totally cycles that just repeat themselves over and over again. Because in 2003, we were talking about an underperforming team that, despite its best efforts to fall away, was only one game out of a wild card spot, even after their horrendous loss. Are you a subscriber, Liz, to the idea that a loss like this isn't that bad because it's only one loss?
No.
Me too.
Like, people who think that, I apologize, but they're psychopaths. Like, for you to think that one thing doesn't have to do with another is, it's like no one does anything in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Psycho, honestly.
I mean, I feel like people who scoff at the idea that a loss is just a one loss is, and that, like, the kind of loss it is doesn't take a toll on the players. You're being particularly ignorant about the fact that those are just meat sacks with brains on top of them running around out there. Losing a game like that means having to dig yourself out of a hole mentally. And I mean, the Phillies, hey, credit, I'm making finger quotes, credit where credit is due. They came out and won 9-3 the next night, and, you know, in a game that they scored runs and didn't give up the lead. Great. But, you know, if you're talking about that one loss being one loss, one win is also just one win. So losing a game like that, nobody except someone with bad brain problems wakes up in the morning having totally eliminated the previous day from their thoughts. So losing the closest thing to a guaranteed win is going to crush you a little bit. But that was the 2003 team on August 27th, as much as it was the 2019 team this past Friday. Part of these crushing losses all occurring in August is because losses like this mean so much more in August, which feeds into the it's more than just one loss argument, when you pretty much have the team you're going to have for the rest of the season. So when you lose like this, it's not just because you lost, it's because the team that's been outfitted with the organization's best efforts to build a contender couldn't win. And it doesn't matter whose specific fault that was at this point. You know, that's all we talk about. But in the end, it really doesn't matter whose specific fault it was, because chances are it was more than one person's fault. And chances are it's too late to fix that problem anyway. So we always find somebody to blame, though. You know, it was Vlasquez, Pivetta, the defensive miscues that kept putting the Marlins on base in 2019. And in 2003, when the Phillies blew an 8-0 lead to the Expos, there was plenty of blame to go around that time, too.
I've had a hard time getting back into the Phillies since that loss. I didn't even watch it live. I watched highlights because I hate myself, but I watched highlights of that loss. Think about that. But, like, I have trouble, and it was just they lost a 7-run lead and then got walloped. Losing an 8-run lead, how do you go to the ballpark the next day?
I want to say that, and they were playing an Expos team that was by no means a last place Marlins team, but also by no means
happen?
A really good, like, 94 Marlins or Expos team. Like, come on. Liz, are you a fan of daily news headlines following terrible Phillies losses? Because this
you
was
you know I am. You absolutely know I am. I listen, I savor those really early Dirty Inning episodes specifically for the headlines.
I gotta tell you, this is probably an all-time favorite of
mine. Oh, yes, I'm ready.
Malice in Squanderland read the Daily News headline.
No!
And it was the best, honestly, that was the best writing in the game recap, which was it was written by Marcus Hayes, who giddily used an overblown boxing metaphor to describe the Phillies getting beaten and spitting up blood and taking all these punches.
Wow, no one's done that before.
All kinds of ridiculous imagery.
Impressive. Did he win an award for that?
Best recap. Special. Here you
best
go.
Best metaphor no one has ever used or thought of before.
I love the sport being used as a metaphor for another sport. But yeah, it was.
There's a whole wide world out there, Marcus.
I will say this. He clearly had a great time writing that.
Well, there's that. At least someone enjoyed themselves.
And I get that instinct, too. That's why we do this podcast. But when that DN headline machine gets rolling sometimes, man, nobody can beat it on their best day. They can't beat that thing. So the way this one went down in Montreal was that the Phillies scored twice in the first inning, with Ricky Ledeay leading off the game with a solo shot. Ricky Ledeay had a hell of a day out there. Jimmy Rollins followed him with a double. Bobby Abreu singled him home. Things settled down until the fourth inning, when the bottom of the fourth, the Phillies roared back to life with Mike Lieberthal singling, Chase Utley hitting a double. Pat Burrell worked a walk, which, hello, walk machine Pat Burrell.
Yeah. Something we've all known forever and say all the time.
One of his known skills, patience and execution. Tomas Perez hit into an RBI groundout. Ledeay hit his second homer of the day, a 3-run shot with two outs, and Abreu added an RBI double to make it 7-0. I mean, this is just butter on bread here. Lieberthal would lead off the fifth with a home run again, and the Phillies were sitting in the dugout with an efficiently earned 8-0 lead, while starter Vicente Padilla cruised through the Expos lineup, starting the game with four straight 1-2-3 innings. I mean, this is not the way this team behaved most of the time. You know, this was part of that era of teams that were like close, but they were like missing one final punch. They fell away in September. They lost a bunch of stupid games in May, and that came back to haunt them. But like, just seeing all these names kind of in a row do really well, I mean, minus somebody like Tomas Perez, it's just kind of like that they're in this cross-generational transitional period. So, like, when you have that fantasy of, like, oh, man, the Phillies had Rollins, Utley, and Howard all at the same time, and then they also have, like, a couple of, like, historical third basemen. Can you imagine if they had been able to fill in that fourth slot with, like, with a Schmidt, with a Rolen? And this is kind of like imagining a team with Jimmy Rollins and Chase Utley, Pat Burrell, Mike Lieberthal, Bobby Abreu. I mean, like, guys that really, I wrote earlier this season, Mike Lieberthal deserved a better era of Phillies baseball. Mm-hmm. And, you know, imagining him playing with these guys in the way we always dreamed of him playing, you know, that's so cool to see this, like, offense kind of do that at least once.
Yeah. Live the fantasy for just a day.
Yeah, but baseball is an unpredictable sport, Liz. But there's so much of it that you can come to expect. so, you know, the Expos were not a remarkable team in 2003, like I said. They'd go 500 in the second half of the season. They'd go 8-11 against the Phillies. And in general, they just didn't seem to have that extra oomph to push them past their just under 500 standing in a lot of categories. Close games, blowout games, interleague games, they were at or under 500 in all of them. So this was the definition of maybe not a bad team, but definitely a beatable team, which, as we know, is exactly the kind of team that can tear the Phillies apart limb from limb. Not when Vicente Padilla is chucking hittable fastballs for 82 of his 92 pitches.
Oh, Vicente.
Yeah, so there were, you want to talk about communication issues. They were having a couple of those at this point on the 2003 Phillies.
Oh, really now?
They started with a minimal rally in the bottom of the fifth, scoring twice the Expos did on RBI groundouts. That seemed harmless enough with such a vast lead for the Phillies. It was 8-3 by the end of the inning, but the Phillies scored two more times in the sixth, recomforting all those watching with a 10-3 lead. Everything's fine. But the Expos added a sack fly to make it 10-4, and then the bottom of the seventh happened. Pitching coach Joe Kerrigan announced after the game that they were going to have a meeting about what had happened. Because what he said, quote,
going to have a meeting about what has happened. It's like,
yeah, not like
parents
we had
are being called into the school.
Not like we had a players-only meeting today. It was like, no, we're going to have a meeting. You don't hear that too often.
We need you to ask us about this meeting, please. We're going to do some things. We're sorry.
Don't forget that we mentioned the meeting, because we're going to want to bring this up tomorrow. Absolutely. pitching coach Joe Kerrigan says, quote, we've got a problem. Our pitch selection and our game planning is not what we say it is in the meeting. It's starting to be a rash through stuff. Why have a meeting if we're not going to do it? Like, he's referring to the meeting he has with his pitcher and his catcher before every game, talking about what they're going to do, how they're going to attack. And apparently they're leaving that all thinking, he's thinking they're all leaving that meeting having the same plan. And then the pitcher gets out there and just starts doing whatever the hell he wants. And he's just like in the dugout ripping his hair out. So after this game, Joe Kerrigan and Larry Boa sat down with Vicente Padilla for what was called a stern 20-minute conversation. But this was had through an interpreter because would only use an interpreter.
I mean, like, interpreters are good or supposed to communicate this stuff, but
I mean, it just adds an extra layer. Like, if you're already having communication issues, but you're not even speaking the same language, I mean, yeah, I wonder what's contributing to this problem. Like, I'm not saying that that's, like, you know, that's a problem to be solved, but it's just definitely another wrinkle in the communication issues. So Padilla was out of the game. Well, I mean, this has been an ongoing issue for the Phillies, the things Kerrigan was mentioning. Randy Wolf seemed to dismiss the plan in his last start, leaving his meeting with Joe Kerrigan, and it was just starting to clearly piss Kerrigan off, which I totally get that. Padilla was out of this game against the Expos by the seventh inning, having set up the Expos to win, but certainly not being the cause of their eventual comeback. A man named Terry Adams entered the game and allowed leadoff singles to former Philly Todd Zeal and future Philly Brian Schneider before throwing a one-out wild pitch that let a run score. This was followed by two subsequent singles that made it 10-6, and by now you could probably pretty much see where this was going. In all of those innings, the innings that we talk about here, when they don't start big, there seems to be some sort of lead up to a killing blow of sorts. I mean, you can't hit a grand slam with the first batter of an inning. You know, a wild pitch isn't going to score a run on the first batter of an inning. So, dirty inning, Liz. since you're not as intimate with the concept, mm-hmm. which you should be glad you aren't, typically, you know, starts a little small with a couple little pokes, little jabs, little stabs in the side, and it leads up to this killing blow. And in this inning, that was Jose Vidro, but it was a double off Mike Williams, the third Phillies pitcher of the inning after, you know, I'd missed this the first time. Dan Plesac had come into the game, given up an RBI single to the only hitter he faced and left.
Oh, great.
Another rewarding Phillies bullpen appearance. Williams just sat in there, giving up a double to Vidro that made it 10-8, intentionally walked Vlad Guerrero because fuck that.
Yeah.
And
why would you do that?
And then gave up an RBI double to both Will Cordero and Zeal. Zeal's was the sign that this one was out of the Phillies' hands. It was a grounder that caromed off Williams' glove, made it clear the team was just not determining the outcome of this one. It was all in the hands of the baseball gods. It was 11-10. Phillies had blown it. They needed a fourth pitcher, Real Cormier, to get out of the inning. But the game wasn't over. And even when the game was over, the Phillies lost 14-10. The season wasn't over. As the Phillies reminded us in the papers in regards to their one-game deficit for the wild card spot that they still had, Jim Thome simply said, it's there, sure. Which is such an interesting
quote. As he begs someone to hit him with a harpoon.
I mean, Liz, I really wanted to unpack this because just three words, but Jim Thome, you know, that's the kindest man on your roster. That's the guy that the beat reporters love because he'll give him a quote. You go up to him and say something, I imagine, as a reporter, and you're just like, okay, so like, Jim, what do you, you know, big loss today, not great, probably a little demoralizing, but you guys are still one game out of the wild card spot. How does this team respond? And, you know, you expect Jim Thome to be like, you know, hey, these guys are young, you know, we're getting it together, we're a team, we're going to rally together, we're going to hold each other up, support everybody, blah, 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 blah. Nope, just gives them a, it's there, sure. Like, there's the wild card, it's right there, but like,
we
no
are
promise
here.
About, we're going to get it.
Just we're like, over oh. here, we're not there.
It's over there. We are here, and things that are here aren't over there. So, yeah, I mean, Liz, if Jim Thome's saying that about your wild card chances, how good are your chances?
I'm going to say real bad. I mean, that's just, it's the quote of a man who's just like, we had it. We could have had it. We had an eight run lead. We could have been there. We could have been over there where the wild card is. We're here. It's there and we're here. And I had to live through that. I had to live through it.
I mean, let me read you these other two quotes from following the game. Because Ricky Ledeh said, everybody should be worried. I think we can rebound, but it has to start today.
Now, it should have started hours before.
I think that, I mean, we're talking about this team, and obviously I'm trying to draw comparisons to the 2019 team when I say this. The Phillies didn't have a Jim Thome equivalent, like a cheerleader, but like, you know, a guy like Bryce Harper, I guess they do. Like, that's who you would probably go to. He's the star. He's the guy people want to hear from, and he's the best hitter on the team right now. So, like, you go to, let's say the equivalent would be going to Bryce Harper right now, but Bryce Harper wasn't there for the Phillies when they lost their game because he was on paternity leave, which, again, is totally excellent and fine. But the problem is that nobody was there to say what Thome said, to be like, hey, you know what? You know, it's there, sure. We're not there. We're not doing a good job of getting there. And then Ledeh, I really liked Ledeh's quote. He's like, we should all be worried. You know, we're good enough to be better than this, but we haven't been. And like, again, who's saying that right now for the Phillies? Nobody's like has the nerve to be a little mean, which in this case would just be a little honest, you know, a little candid about this team's chances. They know they're not going to get to the playoffs playing like they've been playing. They know they're not going to get to playoffs doing what they did tonight, you know, watching a lead, you know, getting a lead back, losing that lead, striking out with the bases loaded, popping out with the bases loaded. I don't know. Has somebody been talking like that? Because I haven't seen it.
No, I don't think so. I mean, everyone just, it's like a disease. What all the Phillies have.
Yes.
Like, Gabe Kapler's weird way of talking has infected everyone. And we just don't hear, like, Bryce Harper will let himself shine through because I just don't think he's capable of not being himself. But I also think he's been affected by it. Like, I want to hear things that sound real. That's too much to ask. I'm sorry.
I mean, and again, like, that's exactly what we were saying last year, which is why this is such a bummer, because this is something that he's supposed to be good at and something he said he was going to work on. But here we are, confused as ever as to what in the hell Gabe Kapler, the communications specialist, is talking about.
He's changed. Since when is – I don't know where we got the idea that he's a communications specialist.
When he came in, like when he came in and he just talked about being open with his player, and like everything he talked about doing was just very appealing, and he's supposed to be, you know, as a player and as a player development lead with the Dodgers. Like, that was his job, was to communicate with players, was to be able to give them what they want, can create this like open culture where he's open to changing, when people suggest change. You know, it was all at the beginning, and we're still so close to the beginning. It's scary how little time has passed since Gabe Kapler was hired, and it's hard to measure the passage of time because the same thing has just been happening over and over again.
He's changed the words he said, but the emotion behind it is the same, and he's just changed the words. He isn't doing anything differently, really. The words are just different. I feel like I'm going crazy. Like, what? I feel bad for the beat writers who have to listen to him.
Yeah, you get an
especially
interesting
at
quote
times like this. Like, mm-hmm. He's just going to say the same thing, and you're the whole thing is going to be a giant supposition of you making an assumption about what he means, because no one knows anything. We're dying. Someone help us. Someone feed our families.
Speaking of managers, obviously Larry Boa weighed in on this loss. Yay. But you know what? He was the chillest of anybody.
Aw, that's no fun.
He shrugged it off. He said, it's devastating, but it's not like there's two games left. So he went with the route of, you know, there's still plenty of time left. This was it was late August, so they still had about a month left in the season. That's not a ton of time if you're the kind of team that's going to start blowing 8-run leads. But, hey, you know, Larry Boa was, at least on the outside, not going to let it eat him up. But that was the most casual use of the word devastating I'd ever read. But I get it. You know, look, the Phillies had done well occasionally in 2003. They may not have had the best clubhouse chemistry, or they may have had the worst clubhouse chemistry. But they had what the Daily News called, quote, the third best bullpen in the league. And that's something I miss reading about for the Phillies. But they had two bigger problems. One was Randy Wolf's delivery was broken. As he was somehow jumping 6 inches backwards in his windup, which was having all sorts of damaging ripple effects as far as where his cutter was cutting.
Yeah, that seems bad.
And preventing him from being able to use that pitch effectively, which then prevented him from being able to use his curveball as effectively because he wasn't setting it up with the cutter. So this was all getting in his head. So then he was having, you know, mental, I keep almost saying mental problems, but, you know, mental issues on the mound. So his last start had been a complete disaster, which is feeding into the Joe Kerrigan narrative of why aren't my pitchers listening to me. The other problem, Liz, and this is going to, I think, be more of a talking point for us. The other problem was that the team had fallen victim to a goatee epidemic.
No!
With everybody growing up. So let my summer vacation.
Oh, the early 2000s. Oh, it was a time for goatees. It was a time.
Let my summer vacation before 11th grade self tell you guys, that doesn't solve anything. You're going to have all your same problems. I mean, Liz, I didn't even really have a goatee. I was just doing, it was the first facial hair I had ever grown. You know, I went to a private Catholic school, so they had more strict rules about facial hair going to school. I used that summer to experiment with facial hair, and, you know, I went with just the chin and just, you know, watched that grow in and then just watched it keep growing and growing and growing. And that's, you know, it definitely didn't get to, who's the guy, who's the musician who has just the chin beard?
I don't know. There's so many, actually.
I know who this is. I keep wanting to say Scott Stapp, but I don't think
that that's Arms that's Wide Creed. Open. My high school boyfriend and I can tell you stories about how that song affected us once upon a time.
Oh, yeah. He's got no facial hair whatsoever.
No. Right,
so that's not who I'm talking about. anyway, in any case, yeah, that solves nothing. I mean, Liz, what is the worst facial hair you remember seeing? And was it from the early 2000s? And I mean on a ball player.
Oh, on a ball player. I was just going to think, like, the number of weird TRL, you know, early 2000s, terrible facial hair, bowl haircut, ridiculousness. That's what flowed into my head. There have been some real bad baseball players' facial hair. I don't understand. Like, Jason Wirth.
Yes.
Early in his career, what was that?
He figured it out. You know, he was like, I'm going to be a big, giant, terrifying beard guy. And that worked for him.
It did. Yeah. It would work perfectly for him. It was so much better than the landing strip on his chin. Like, it looked like it was a puppet thing glued to his face.
Yes, I remember. That's exactly the thing that comes to mind for me. Him and Aaron Rowan and a couple of those guys right around that time in, like, 05, 06, 07. Those guys were all doing that coffee drip down the chin thing. And it was just like, what are we doing?
Utley had that soul patch for 11,000 years. And we all just let it slide. We all just let it go and acted like it wasn't there. We pretended it was okay because he's Chase Utley. But we all knew it was offensive. We all knew it had no place on his face. And we all wondered why his lovely wife didn't tell him to shake that stupid thing off.
Look, Liz, I would do it again. I'd let him do it again.
We all would. I would. But it would be nice to go through it again with the acknowledgement that, yeah, that's bad, but we're going to let you do it.
Yes. I will say, you know, hey, as men who grow facial hair, we experiment. You know, we sometimes don't know our own power. We don't know our own strength of the hair growing out of our faces. And sometimes you got to see what something looks like, and sometimes you don't have the measurement skills or the context to judge whether what that looks like is terrible or just even repulsive. Sometimes you think, yeah, the hair growing out of my chin that looks like a bunch of like moss on the underside of a wet log. That's what's gonna get girls to talk to me. Absolutely, I'm a grown man now. Maybe I'm starting a small business. Maybe I'm starting 11th grade. It's impossible to tell the difference.
You know, with facial hair, it's like, you know, there's this with women. Was it Coco Chanel said, when you leave the house, look in the mirror, take one thing off. With men, the goatee is the middle. You never want to be there. You can either add more and turn it into a beard, or add less. And, you know, you could do a mustache, or you can shave it all off. Those are your choices.
Yes.
And, like, there's some guys who can do big mutton chops. You have to figure out what more is best. The answer is never a goatee. It's almost never a goatee.
I think that's great advice. And I think that's a good time to close the 2003 portion of this episode of The Dirty Inning. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to dive a couple more decades back in time to the time before 2003 when the Phillies suffered one of their dumbest and worst losses in history.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this break. Well, Liz, it was, this was a loss in 2003 that the Phillies dropped to the Expos. They lost 14-10 after starting the game with an 8-run lead. This was a loss the Phillies wouldn't suffer again for 16 years and hadn't suffered since for the last 24 years in 1979. So let's take a trip even further back, why don't we, to another time when all was lost. The Inquirer headline on August 12, 1979, for the game we're going to talk about next, courtesy of Jason Stark, read, "There are two ways to look at the Phils today, sadly or not at all."
So. Man. You know, I have my issues with Jason Stark in the recently, but he was cutting back in the day. He knew how to turn a phrase, and he knew how to write about some of those craptastic Phillies teams.
Man, they all were, and Stark was not. He wasn't holding back. I mean, I think again we talk about August, and this game occurred on August 11th, 1979.
August is the worst month for the Phillies. It always is and always will be. They had a terrible August in 2011, and they won 102 games.
Yeah, there's a reason all of these innings and all of these games happen in August. Like I said, this is we've talked about the dog days of summer. We've talked about this is when guys are at their most hurt or sweatiest or most tired. And you know what? That goes for the writers, too. Mm-hmm. But also, they're, like, watching this team. And by August, it's like, yeah, if this team's going to drop an 8-run lead in August, then screw this.
Why am I here? Why are any of us here?
I've decided I'm not going to pull any punches. moving forward here. There's an objective look at baseball. There's, you know, a little analysis and narratives to be drawn out. But that's for April coverage. In August, we're all armpit deep in our own sweat. And
it feels like a bog outside all the time.
Well, manager Danny Ozark in 1979 had hidden in his office after the game, not desiring particularly to speak to reporters. It's a hilarious scene, Stark describes, where Ozark literally like pokes his head out, slinks out to check and see if any players were reporting injuries in the trainer's room, only to return to his office and find a pair of reporters waiting to chat.
That's why you don't leave.
Mm-hmm. What's brilliant about this is that around the time of this loss, the Phillies were on the cusp of celebrating their 1964 team, a team known for one thing and one thing only, letting everyone down in the most epic way possible. What we forget
about celebration time.
What we forget about that team and that losing streak that ended the 1964 season was that it was preceded by a lot of winning, which was why it was so devastating. So the Phillies were going to honor the 15th anniversary of that team by inviting a bunch of the players back for an old-timers game.
So they can all get drunk and reminisce about how they all blew it fantastically.
Oh,
wow.
Absolutely. Yes. That's, I mean,
there's nothing more Phillies than that, I don't think. Is there?
No, and honestly, it reminded me a lot. It's not close to this, but it reminded me a lot of having the 2009 team come back, because you know they fell just shy of winning the World Series, but you know you bring them back anyway because they did a lot of winning. But what we remember about that team most is you know how the season ended, mm-hmm. which was with a loss. So this meant this old-timers game meant that Dallas Green, Jim Bunning, Johnny Callison, Clay Dalrymple, Chris Short, Ruben Amaro, Tony Taylor, our boy John Boozer from our last episode of The Dirty Inning, and many others were coming back to town. The headline in the Inquirer read cheekily, "The 1964 Phillies, in parentheses, remember them?"
Oh.
In Old Timers game, August 25th. So mean.
Remember them? Oh, God. That's
hilarious.
Painful. That's why you don't bring them back.
Hilariously enough, Ozark would be fired during the 1979 season, and Green, who was invited back for this celebration, would be invited back to Philadelphia on a more permanent capacity to take his managing job. Mm-hmm. So the Phillies were just stacking disappointment on top of disappointment right now, and the 14-11 loss to the Pirates on August 11th really fit that mold. Fortunately, this Phillies team was a little better than the 2003 team, was only 1 year away from a World Series championship, but this loss still had to sting, and given that they once again blew an 8-run lead to lose it, that makes a lot of sense. So, after scoring on a Larry Boa sac fly and a Pete Rose triple in the second, the Phillies put together a real stinger of an inning in the third. Greg Luzinski hit a 2-run shot, Larry Boa's RBI single, and an error on the throw allowed a run to score, as did a wild pitch from the Pirates' Joe Coleman. Pete Rose and Manny Trio bashed some hits to knock in a few more runs, and the Phillies had a 6-run outburst that gave them their 8-0 lead. Problem was, there were still 6 more innings to play, and the Pirates used just about all of them. They scored 5 in the 5th, and Dickie Knowles failed to contain Omar Moreno and Willie Stargell, followed by a brief hit parade after Kevin Saucier had come in to relieve him. They scored 4 more and took the lead in the 7th on a Dave Parker bomb, a Phil Garner double, and a Mike Easler single. And just for fun in the 8th, Ed Ott bashed a grand slam off Tug McGraw, and then the Phillies were really losing, 13-8. Much like last week's Marlins disaster, the Phillies pushed a few across in the 9th, but nowhere near enough, and lost 14-11. And as the Inquirer wrote, health, pitching, and the season had all, quote, disintegrated at this point. They wrote, yesterday was just one more loss in a season, actually a century, of crushing losses.
Wow.
Yeah. So grim. I mean, this is 1979. They hadn't even won their first World Series title
yet. I mean, it's amazing what those World Series wins will do for your outlook on what is it largely a really difficult franchise to love. It's amazing what that will do, and I can't imagine living in that time and having nothing to cling to.
I mean,
like every angry recap, every recap of every bad game would be another, let's just put another hash mark on the, you know, on the long prison wall of time spent with the Phillies.
Seriously. I mean, when you said that, like, there's nothing to cling to, it would just feel like you're drowning. I mean, honestly, we live in such a golden era of Phillies baseball.
We can remember the last World Series. We can remember it. We can remember the last 100 and, you know, 100 plus team. We can remember the last great rotation and the last great prospects. There are teams that can't do that. Yeah. The Phillies were that team for a long time.
Almost 100 years they were that team. I mean, good Lord. It was the same woe is us, screw this team language you're kind of seeing now. And as we're saying,
it explains,
you know,
so much about the city as a whole.
Yes, doesn't it?
Not just Phillies, it bleeds over to other sports too. This the whole city needs a psychiatrist.
that's a fair classification. There's always a sense when the tide has turned. The Pirates won the East in 1979. The Phillies finished fourth. But you know what? They collected themselves, came back the next year, and, well, you know, we all know what happened. So maybe there's a lesson to be learned in there as well, that finishing and not making the playoffs doesn't mean that you're defining the era. It just means this was, you know, didn't happen this year. It's not going to happen most years. It's, as we have learned, it's only really happened 2 years for the Phillies, and it's been over a century at this point. So, but as Jason Stark summed it up, the Phillies might well rebound and win today or even tomorrow, but they have let too many of these just one games slip away to win it all in September. And he capitalizes J, O, and G for just one games. There is no way they can face this or admit this, but they are not going to make it four division titles in a row. So here's a Phillies beat writer just straight up saying in the newspaper, this team is not going to the playoffs. It's August 11th. It's not out of the question that they could go to the playoffs, but he's just, you know, and he was right. And I'm sure anyone watching is thinking the same thing. And I just, you know, it boggles my mind a little bit, even though I've been doing this long enough that it shouldn't, but just how similar it always sounds. Like, a losing season always sounds the same. It just does, you know, and it can be a losing season in a couple of different ways. The narratives might be a little different, but they always sound the same. And this sounds like exactly, if you read that passage in tomorrow's coverage of tonight's game, it would make total sense. It fits perfectly. There's not any specific mentions. You know, they've just let too many of these just one games slip away. And that's why I think the it's just one loss mentality doesn't work anymore. It's August. That's kind of the time when all your just one games start adding up into just, you know, 60 or 70 games. So let me ask, we've talked it. We dwelled enough on how much this team has been a bummer. So let's just finish up here with something that's not quite on topic, but, part of this. It's been a part of this whole thing. So let me ask you something, Liz. Is there anybody who is more Phillies, if you're using the word as an adjective, is there anybody who is more Phillies in history than Larry Boa?
No, I was going to talk about him earlier. I was going to say something like, you know, Larry Boa's earned the right to be chill about this loss. He's lived through a lot of them.
Yeah. And not only that, he shows up in the 2003 game as the manager. He shows up in the 1979 game as a player. Like, he's in both of these terrible losses, and I mean, he's still with the organization now. I'm not sure there's anybody who's more Phillies than Larry Boa. There's players we like, and certainly players who were better. But Boa played here forever and was great. He managed here, he coached here, and he's still here. He's always just around. He has no interest in really getting invested in other organizations at this point, I would imagine. He is a character in so many of the stories we tell in the Dirty Inning, the good and the bad. And I think he might just be the Philliesest Phillies guy in the history of the Phillies. He's dedicated most of his life to this team. He's sung on the Phillies Fever record.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
More of his life has been with this team than without them at this point. And I just felt like that had to be said.
I can't disagree with you. You're completely right. I mean, he gave a very touching tribute at David Montgomery's memorial service. He cried during the press conference when he talked about him. He was so deeply connected to this team, you know, and to how it was built and how it became the team it was today. He was there at the beginning. He was there, and, you know, close to the start, and he wasn't there the whole time, but he was there when the Phillies started becoming the Phillies that we knew them to be for, you know, 40, 50 years. And, you know, they seem to be not being anymore.
Yeah. And, yeah, he's born in Sacramento, raised in Sacramento. So it's not like he's a Philly guy literally, but, man.
He's a Philly guy.
Somebody. He is, though. You know, he's a Phillies guy. He's definitely, like, you know, his personality, his emotions, you know, it's you imagine him being mad so much of the time because that's the kind of guy he is. But, you know, you're right. He's certainly not above crying when in like a moment like that when everybody's emotions are raw.
The team is his and life.
Yeah, and it's Larry Boa who they go to every time there's been a tragedy, like Harry Callis passing away, like David Montgomery passing away. I mean, you know, Larry Boa's he's just always around. He is the Phillies.
You don't have to be born in Philly or from Philly to be a Philly guy.
Absolutely not, yeah.
There's a statue of Rocky Balboa in that city.
You don't even have to be real.
You don't have to be real. Like, Larry Boa is real. Let's cherish him. Celebrate him as he should be celebrated. He gave us one of the most iconic moments of the last, what, 5 years, 10 years? You know, at least of losing seasons. Mm-hmm. Yelling fuck you from the top, you know, from like one of the steps of the dugout at who, Hansel Robles?
Yeah, it was awesome.
God, yes. Look at him. He's what, 78 years old? He's ready to throw down? I love it.
Of a quick pitch. God, he got so upset over a quick
pitch. For a quick pitch. God, like, he's the best. He's just the best, and I love him.
Yeah. And, you know, it's guys like that who make dirty innings. You know, he had to live through so many dirty innings to get through the few precious glory moments that the Phillies have undergone. And so, Liz, as we're recording this, the Phillies are currently tied 5-5
at
the top of the 11th the Pittsburgh Pirates.
When we started, they were leading. They at one point, they had, what, a 2 or 3 run lead?
Mm-hmm. Gave it up in the eighth or the ninth. Super. The ninth. Gave it up in the top of the ninth. Hector Neris did. Gave up a home run.
Top
Phillies couldn't
the
put
ninth.
It together.
It's
you know,
like
they loaded,
they're trying to kill us.
They loaded the bases. Rhys Hoskins popped out, fouled out. Bryce Harper struck out. You know, this team's not getting it together. So I bring this up because, hey, very recently they made some history making with one of their worst losses of this season. 2003, they did the same thing. 1979, they did the same thing. Every era. We could have gone back decades and found more losses, I'm sure. Worse losses than that. Just going through history. Every era has at least one. If you're lucky, you only have one. Who knows how this team will lose in the future? Who knows how many more leads of at least 7 runs they'll blow in the years ahead? But all we can say is each of those teams had a future ahead of them, whether it was the 79 Phils the next year or the Chase Utleys, Pat Burrells, and Jimmy Rollins on that 03 team who came back and 5 years later won this town a World Series title. I don't always end these podcasts on a positive note, but guys, history and the march of time is the only thing that is inevitable. So the Phillies will probably, before the end of the world, win another World Series. We don't know when exactly that's going to be. It's probably not going to be this year, but this year doesn't mean that they have eliminated the possibility in the Bryce Harper era, let's just say, of Philadelphia Phillies history. Just because one loss stops being one loss around August doesn't mean that one season can't just be one season. So hopefully things get restructured, guys find their mojo, and this becomes as scary a team as it deserves to be with guys like Harper and Real Muto on it. So moving ahead, I think we'd like to see as few 7-run leads blown as possible, but when they blow them, we'll be here on the Dirty Inning ready to tell you how stupid they were.
Yay.
Yay. Well, thank you for listening, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all the Phillies podcasts. They're your absolute favorite Phillies podcasts on the Good Fight Podcast Network. That's Hit and Season with John Stolness, Continued Success with myself and Liz, and of course this podcast, The Dirty Inning. We appreciate you. We love you. Stay safe out there. You might as well turn this game off now. Go ahead and, for your own self-care. And we'll talk to you next time on The Dirty Inning.